Does your theory or about in support of exhaustion depend on whether the individual is represented or not represented?
The way we see it is that that is certainly a factor consistent with Majeed. And that would be up to the court on a case-by-case basis, weighing the competing interests of the individual and in this case, the agency. And I think it's a very important factor. And in fact, Majeed cites it as the only factor they discuss when they support their case-by-case analysis. So I think it is certainly, I don't know if we're advocating a black letter line, but certainly in this case, it's a very important factor. In fact, the fact that the attorney came in at the NOD level, as opposed to many attorneys come in after a board decision, and Majeed actually discussed that in depth, the fact that often at that earlier stage, people are unrepresented in the process.
And how does that square with the fact that Sims involved a situation where the individual was represented?
Again, I think the Supreme Court in Sims was applying it solely to the Social Security system. And this system, the VA adjudicatory system, requires additional effort or at least specificity on the part of appellants and in this case a representative appellant. But I would say we wouldn't treat someone who's represented any differently than someone who's not represented. However, we're asking the court to certainly consider that when they determine if an issue wasn't raised or a theory was not raised, and that should be a very important in the court.
I'm sorry, I want to follow up on what you're saying. So you're saying the agency itself doesn't treat parties differently, whether they are represented or not, but you're asking the court to do so once they get here?
Yes, Your Honor. In a case like this, where a person was represented for a number of years below, failed to raise these theories, in fact, I would even say misdirected the agency in its adjudication of the claims, I think now when that individual, the appellant, wants to raise new theories at this level, the court, in the interest of efficiency, should certainly consider that.
Well, if I can just sort of pursue that a little bit. The only reason that they are here is because they have been receiving, they have received a final board decision denying their claim for benefits. So if we just assume that in this case, Mr. Robinson had instead received a remand after 6 or 7 years of pursuing his benefit claim at the VA, and at that point on remand raised a new theory based on direct service connection, then wouldn't the system be in the same place, the VA be in the same place, the parties be in the same place of protracting litigation, of perhaps slowing down other veterans' claims and pursuing Mr. Robinson's claim? The only difference is that it's at the court. So isn't that the agency treating it differently?
I just want to clarify, are you saying if it was after a remand upon remand to the board? The difference is the agency would have had the chance to address these issues in the first instance.
Well, if we remand it now, the agency would have the same opportunity to address it in the first instance.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand what you're saying. I think that frustrates the process, knowing that you can sit silent for years and then know at some point, if you don't raise it, you have the option of going to an appeals court and then raising new issues, which has the discretion not to.
I'm sorry, I just need to sort of follow up on that a little bit. What would the appellant gain by holding back an argument?
Frankly, Your Honor, I don't think the appellant in this case himself had anything to gain. As we discussed in our supplemental pleading, I think in some instances counsel may be the ones that had something to gain. Honestly, and in this case, I don't believe that ultimately, whatever the disposition is after we have arguments, that Mr. Robinson will be entitled to service connection on any theory, and that's just my own opinion. However, an attorney involved in a case that will unlikely have past due benefits recovery does have something to gain. And if there's nothing raised before the agency and one holds back and then raises either administrative or procedural or the like to this court, the attorney will be compensated.
Not under Maggot. If we remand it for not having raised the argument in the first instance, our case law does not provide for EJA benefits, so he would not receive that. And under the factors that should Mr. Robinson ultimately receive any past due benefits, it seems that this could be considered as a factor, as in Skates' whether he fairly earned the benefits that he fairly earned the payment that he would receive. So again, I'm sort of trying to see, you know, that there isn't already provision in the system to take care of if somebody is acting in a perhaps not the most forthright manner without potentially prejudicing Mr. Robinson.
In this case, the Magid issue was developed. In other cases, it does happen, especially, for instance, a very early remand when the, say there isn't a record developed, and it's purely based on a board decision or just discussing the case with an attorney, many times that Magid error is not identified. And in those cases, there might be a quick early procedural remand that allows the attorney to get paid.
But that is at the discretion of the agency. They have agreed as a party to a joint remand. And as the secretary is the government's representative and the government is the one paying the EJIA fees, again, that's the government's responsibility and involvement. So, again, I'm just trying to have to see where the, other than the time involved, which I think could happen just as easily as if it had not come to the court and it had been remanded, what the harm is to the system.
I think all of what if we talk about in this case, Your Honor, back in 1999 in the NOD, it was clearly communicated that the claim was had been the theory addressed or recognized by the regional office was for secondary service connection. Had Mr. Cameron raised that and said, I'm to the RO, I think you've developed this wrong and there is another theory you haven't caught reviewing the record and the pleading. The time is significant. That's now 8 years that have elapsed from that time. And I think that's, we can't look at that lightly. And that's also 8 years more if in the event past due benefits would be paid at a rate to the attorney that would come out of the appellant's pocket, potentially.
Well, even Mr. Robinson in his initial argument here has indicated that in retrospect, the claim should have been prosecuted perhaps in a different manner. What I've heard you talk about for the last several minutes is the ineffectiveness of the counsel and how the counsel might profit from that or benefit from that. But I think as Judge Solon indicated, can't that be taken care of by the agency looking at the fee agreement that the individual, that the attorney has with Mr. Robinson, and then making a judgment based upon that, which we would then be able to, if the attorney didn't agree with that judgment, this court would be able to look at that. That's where the, it seems to me, that is the way to remedy the problem that you are raising right now.
Your Honor, maybe, and I can get to that, and I think that maybe the problem, I haven't communicated it clearly enough, is a systemic problem and what the benefits of exhaustion are to everyone. And I think, and then if we say yes, certainly it can be raised later in the future that it may affect the attorney's recovery of past due benefits if he's eligible. But in the meantime, I think the primary consideration in cases like this is actually exhaustion helps veterans in general. And I think it's been communicated by the appellant that exhaustion is a bad thing. And in reality, that is the system needs that in order to keep cases moving, promote efficiency, to allow the agency in the first instance to write these. If there are any wrongs, so let the agency step in rather than letting years elapse and time go by and disabilities change to then have a chance years later. I think that's a message that we're just trying to communicate that it's a systemic problem to allow people to go for years and sit down, especially.
So what, in order to fix that problem, what would you have the court do?
And then I would have the court apply basically the analysis in the sheet or Magid, as it said. The court must consider in the case, case by case, representation of an attorney is a factor. And I believe in this case, the representation is certainly a factor.
I understand. A factor in what?
In its analysis of whether, on a case by
And what would that cause the court to do?
In this instance, it would cause the court to affirm the decision because no
one affirm the decision and not consider his argument for direct service connection?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, let's assume that we don't adopt that. Let's look at the merits of this case. What is the agency's position on, as I understood the appellant, their argument for remand is based upon the fact that the board decision in its remand order directed that the VA provide a medical opinion on the etiology of two conditions, a thyroid condition and a heart condition, or allegations of disabilities with those two organs, and that that was not accomplished. Now, what is your position on that argument?
Okay, well, first of all, Your Honor, the remand was clearly premised on the fact that the board was considering it as claims for secondary service connection at that point. The only real question posed to the examiner to directly answer was, and I quote, whether it is likely as not that any thyroid or another one, the heart disorder, if diagnosed, was caused or aggravated by the service connected peptic ulcer disease. That's the final sentence of the paragraph. And the board did request the examiner, in order to get to that ultimate analysis and to answer that question, to discuss such factors as the etiology of the disease. And I believe that the examiner in this case did address them. As Mr. Schiff conceded, that we were in agreement that the heart disorder was, the etiology was addressed as being related to thyroid disorder. And it's clear in the examination report that the thyroid condition was associated with the Graves' disease that he had well after service. I think that the examiner, I mean, his primary objective was to address whether or not it was related to the peptic ulcer disease in service. And that was, I think that's how the remand was communicated, and the doctor followed that.
Okay, then how do you explain the first portion of the first sentence in both remand orders, which it's on page 190 of the record, and I think also on 188 or 189. The RO should arrange for a VA examination by, in this case, a cardiovascular specialist in order to determine the nature, severity, and etiology of any cardiovascular disorder.
And in this case, Your Honor, unfortunately, because it was not raised before the board, and it really wasn't really raised to this court, Mr. Cameron, who wrote the brief, kind of threw out there that the doctor may not be a cardiovascular specialist and also said he may.
I haven't heard any argument about that aspect of the inadequacy. As a matter of fact, we asked very specific questions about why the exam was inadequate, and the argument that I understood, and of course Mr. Chisholm can tell us differently on when he gets up, was it was solely based upon the fact that the regional office or whoever conducted the exam did not comply with the order that was in the board's remand, and that was to basically comply with that sentence that I read there. And as I understand it, that's the sole argument that's on the table now. I understand there's other things discussed in the brief.
Yes, Your Honor. And I might have misunderstood your question because I was looking at the sentence. So you're referring to the determined nature, severity, and etiology of the cardiovascular disorder.
That's correct.
I believe that was addressed in the remand. I have to say, I don't know. I'm not honestly sure if the severity, for example, was addressed. Mm-hmm. However, in this case, I don't. Since we're not at the stage where we'd actually be assigning a disability rating based on severity, I think in that instance, any deficiency would be harmless. Now, at any time a service connection were actually granted, that certainly could be problematic if the severity were not discussed.
Is there any impact to the fact that that's one sentence in a paragraph? And the actual and part of that paragraph, which really speaks directly to the examiner, says the examiner is requested to render an opinion as to whether it is likely as not that any cardiovascular disorder, and says the same with the thyroid disorder, if diagnosed, was caused or is aggravated by service-connected peptic ulcer disease. Does that have any impact on our analysis of that first sentence?
Your Honor, I believe it does. It's clearly communicated by the board that their intent was for the examiner to develop and assess the veteran, to determine what his disabilities were, and to know the general
sort of follows one of Judge Schoen's questions to Mr. Chisholm, and that is, what do you believe is necessary? What is the scope of the VA's obligation to address all theories presented by a claim?
I think that the scope of it would be, I'll use this case as an example. There are, of course, three theories, as was discussed: direct, secondary, and presumptive. And the evidence that was presented in this case, along with the pleadings, no theory was specifically alleged. However, if one reads the record, the service medical records, and subsequent examinations, it was clear that the only theory that could potentially be raised by the evidence of record was secondary. In this instance, there was no evidence whatsoever of a direct basis. There was no diagnosis, and there was not evidence covering a presumptive basis. So the RO, in doing the right thing, determined that, well, maybe if this veteran is claiming his conditions developed 10 years after service, then he must be taking them as secondary, because that's the only theory of entitlement he might be eligible to receive them on.
How much can VA rely on his lay statement as to the start date of these conditions in controlling their scope of their look?
I think we rely on somewhat, but again, since we sympathetically read all the evidence of record, that his lay statements regarding the start date were confirmed by the evidence of record. And in this case, we even asked him to provide all medical records or report of where he'd been treated since the day he left service. So I think the record supports, I believe he said his onset dates were actually slightly before the time he was diagnosed. I believe his application was like in 1996. I don't think he diagnosed these until 1998.
Now, Mr. Chisholm has pointed to a couple of instances in the record that note that there were chest pains or spots between before his eyes, and that those might be evidence of thyroid condition as early as, I believe, 1988. Why is that evidence not sufficient to trigger a look at a perhaps presumptive or direct service connection?
Your Honor, number one, the reports of chest pains that were cited at 36 and 44, I have not found any notation of chest pains, and that's during service. And then he's addressing, I believe, a VA examination in, I want to say, 1988. And in that, he has his own reports, not confirmed by the examiner, of regular chest pains and see black dots. And he actually, in his briefing, provides a footnote to discuss that there are eye conditions. I'll just point out that actually that footnote itself does not indicate there's anything involving, say, black dots. And further, he's never been found to have that eye disability ever since his diagnosis.
Well, irrespective of what the appellant has argued here, I'm just sort of, again, trying to explore what is the springboard for VA's obligation to examine different theories of service connection. If the appellant is qualified to state that he sees spots, I'm not really sure what kind of clinical evidence would confirm or disprove that, but why is that not evidence that can potentially trigger a look?
I don't know how any VA rating specialist would ever have been able to interpret those statements that were not confirmed by the physician on examination as raising any type of claim for any disability, not especially the disabilities we have in this instance. I just don't think the descriptions, if we wanted to use those two phrases in the 1988 exam, would ever reasonably communicate that he was, that there would be an entitlement based on it, a disability for them.
Okay, well, assuming that that's so, then is your reliance completely then on the fact that the appellant did not direct you to these as being evidence of perhaps direct service connection at an earlier stage than now?
I don't see these as, it's not that the veteran didn't direct us. I just don't think to anyone it would have been not even obvious but apparent that there was a disability involving a thyroid or a heart condition, especially when the chest pains that have been discussed throughout the evidence of record were all associated with epigastric pain from his
well, once somebody starts claiming that they have a heart condition, prior reports of chest pain could be seen as relevant evidence.
Again, but we're looking at the time, Your Honor, in 1988.
Or in 1996, or 2004, or...
And it has, Your Honor, been confirmed by the evidence of record that there was no heart condition since... the heart condition preceded the diagnosis of Graves' disease, which resulted in the hyperthyroidism. I don't see that these subjective complaints that, after examination by the examiner, were unconfirmed, bear any relevance to a direct service connection claim. It would be very difficult to interpret that being as some sort of demonstration that, in fact, he had thyroid disease or Graves' disease or a heart disorder.
Well, I want to take maybe a broader, bigger picture look. One of the things that I'm sort of troubled or struggling with is the idea in Schroeder that, again, the VA has an obligation to look at all theories. And I'm trying to figure out what the trigger for that would be and how would VA comply with that obligation. You know, would it require a board decision to state theory A, no, theory B, no, theory C, yes, or whatever? Or does there have to be some requisite evidence triggering even a discussion of it?
I think the latter, Your Honor. I think we distinguish this from the analysis in Schroeder. In this case, Mr. Robinson did not ever assert that he had these conditions in service.
But I don't. That's one of the questions I have. Does the veteran have to make this assertion, or does the evidence have to exist? Are you guided by what an attorney might argue, or are you guided by what the evidence shows?
Your Honor, I think if the evidence doesn't exist, then the attorney or the appellant itself does have to assert it, because there would really be no other way for the regional office to make that determination, or in this case find that there was a theory of direct service connection that was viable, if it's not apparent. And I think in this case, when the record, the service medical records, all the post-service medical records that we requested since the day since its discharge.
Okay, well, getting back to sort of the broader picture, if there is no evidence, does VA have some sort of obligation to state presumption X doesn't apply, direct service connection doesn't apply, or do they only have to discuss the theory that they are pursuing?
I believe it would be just the theory that is the reasonably raised theory. I don't think we want to see decisions where they have to go through every criteria under presumptive and address for you in Vietnam, yes, no, for you in Korea, yes. Radiation exposure. That's not the purpose of a rating decision, is to communicate whether compensation or benefits are granted and the reason why. And in this case, the only theory that was viable was the secondary service connection theory. And I think it was proper to limit the decision, especially in the event that you say you have a pro se veteran who's it makes it much more easy for them to understand the reason why it was denied. And in this case, I'll just add that the veteran, with the aid of counsel, even clarified back to the regional office that the claim was for secondary service connection.
I know you're out of time.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that none of the judges have any other questions before we allow you to sit down. Judge Lance?
Thank you. Counselor, what significance, if any, does the agency, the VA, place upon the veteran's refusal or failure to cooperate, I believe, in two instances reflected in the record?
Again, all cases are, whether represented or not, are treated the same. However, if the counsel does not cooperate, and in this case, where the evidence isn't apparent, say the theory is directly not apparent from the record, and if counsel doesn't cooperate either, and ultimately it's denied, I think it does have an impact on the veteran. Probably a case that there was such a theory that should have been asserted would have had to have been raised by the attorney or the agent or the veteran. And I think, again, going back to the McMaggot analysis, I think that should be, again, a factor considered by the court, with the representation status, and that's up to the court.
Thank you.
I have one question. If we were to find that a claim on a direct basis and a claim asserted on a secondary basis were separate claims as opposed to a single separate theories to a single claim. Would that make any difference on our analysis of this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor, just because, again, there has never been any evidence put forward supporting a direct basis. If that answers your question.
Well, the appellant's asking for a remand because they're saying that the VA has an obligation to decide this claim on all theories, one of which is a direct theory. I say if we find that asserting that you have service connection on a direct basis is a separate, entirely separate claim.
I guess the Secretary disagrees with that analysis, Your Honor. Clearly in this case, the claim was for a benefit, and I don't see how we can get to separate claims. I mean, the application clearly states that it's an application for benefits, and we don't request that appellants fill out separate applications saying I want it secondary versus I want it presumptive or direct. And I think the only way that we can efficiently process claims is to accept them as a claim for a general entitlement and then just determine which theory is viable.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any more questions, Your Honor? Okay, on behalf of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, I ask this court to affirm the May 17, 2004 decision of the board. The contentions raised were without merit, and affirmance, therefore, is the appropriate disposition. And in the alternative, if the court does find there's any merit to the contentions, we ask the court to consider the factors specified in Magid, which would permit the court to determine that the appellant did not exhaust his remedies below. Finally, and probably most importantly, an affirmance in this appeal will send a compelling message for attorneys that are appearing before the agency that they would be required to advocate on behalf of their clients and pursue the remedies at the theory at the appropriate time rather than before this court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chisholm, if you need additional time in light of our extension of time here, you'll have it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to go to page 122 of the record, which is where the claim was filed, echo something that Mr. Bell just said, and that is the application for benefits just states nature of sickness, disease, or injuries for which the claim is being made. So what he's seeking, and as I said in my opening remarks, was benefits, disability benefits for both the thyroid and heart condition, and it's not limited any one theory, and the application doesn't require it. The other issue I wanted to go to was something you just...
Well, now, with regard to the thyroid and the heart, he does indicate that they apparently first arose in 1996.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's his understanding of when they arose.
Okay.
He's not a medical expert, and there's no question that that was his thinking at that time. Can't dispute that. The other issue is that I'd like to discuss in rebuttal is on page 189, and that is the board reason. You're quite correct that in determining the specific question, one could say that the examiner's request to provide an opinion as to whether it's as likely as not that the thyroid if diagnosed was caused and aggravated by the service-connected peptic ulcer disease, we have the answer to that question. I don't think we have the answer to the first part of that question, the nature disease and the etiology of the disease. And I think both are required by the terms of this remand, and I think it would be a narrow reading just to limit it to that second part of the secondary condition. And if the court were inclined to limit the analysis to just that last sentence about secondary service connection, that in essence becomes an adverse determination. This remand order would be adverse to the veteran because it doesn't require them to answer the first part. Question, query whether that's an appealable event at that point. I don't think it is limited. I think the opinion was to address not just the secondary, but the actual etiology of the condition.
Let me see if I understand your argument. And your argument would be, I guess this is what we do, parse words, and that is that what you have here is two directions to the RO. a direction that is contained in the first sentence, which says the RO should arrange for an examination by an appropriate specialist in order to determine severity, nature, and etiology. And a second direction to the examiner to provide this specific, in addition to these general opinions, to provide a specific opinion with regard to the relationship to his already service-connected disability. Is that correct?
That is how I read it.
Okay.
Absolutely. This case really presents the court with this issue of the tension between what happens at the agency, which is non-adversarial, and what happens here, obviously, which is adversarial. I think the lens of the court should be on the non-adversarial system below, and should be on what the board did or didn't do, not what counsel did or didn't do below. What we seek here is a remand for the board to consider the theory of a direct service connection and a presumptive within 1 year service connection claim. If there's no further questions.
I actually would like to pursue some of the questions that I was with Ms. Rogal about. She finds that the evidence doesn't raise a direct service connection claim, in her opinion. And so what was there for VA to go on? Why didn't they act reasonably in only pursuing the secondary service connection claim?
I think the evidence is in the, first of all, once you look at both the 88 exam and the 2002 exam conducted by the same examiner, we know that the heart condition is secondary to the thyroid condition, accepting that. And the question is, was there evidence of the thyroid condition and the eye problems that he noted that he's competent to testify, I see black dots, under Leno, he's competent to say that that's the trigger. Is that an early manifestation of the Graves' disease or the thyroid condition? And I don't think we're all competent to make that determination. I think that has to be a medical determination, but that's evidence of the condition or potentially evidence of the condition. And is that a plausible? I think it is. And I think that's what required them to get the opinion on etiology.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. Before we bring counsel, I would like to take the opportunity to recognize an individual who's provided great service to the court. Marvin Jacobs, who is our marshal in the back. Today is will be his last oral argument, and it's his last day at the court. He served the court for 12 years.
16 years, sir.
15 years. I don't want to mistake it. I was going to say that I really wasn't certain at the time, but I know that every time I came to the court, from the time I came.